Thanks a lot for the introduction. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak here and also for visiting here. I have talked with many of you and I truly learned a lot, and it's very enjoyable. Although my stay is kind of short, I wish I could stay longer here. So today I will tell you some of my recent work on entanglement entropy in 1 plus 1D with defects. So just start with some motivation. So my motivation to this subject comes from two parts. The first part of motivation is the study of quantum entanglement. So quantum entanglement recently has been attracting lots of attention for all the good reasons. So first of all, quantum entanglement could be viewed as a resource for manipulating computational tasks. And therefore, it has a very important role to play in the study of quantum information and quantum computing. Secondly, in condensed matter physics, quantum entanglement could be used for various different purposes. So for example, it could be used to diagnose quantum critical phenomena. It could also be used to study dynamics of strongly coupled quantum systems, and it could be used to characterize quantum phases of matter. Now, from the formal point of view of quantum field theories, quantum entanglement are also very important subjects. So first of all, it could be used as a probe of phase transition, such as a confinement-deconfinement transition. And it could be also be used to measure degrees of freedom of under the RG flows for the quantum field theories. So my talk today will only be touching upon like a small subset of these motivations, which in particular two of them, which are labeled by red, so namely diagonalize quantum critical phenomena and measure this degree of freedom, which are like a good quantity along the RG flow. The second motivation is the study of defects. So a lot of my past work has been focused on defects in supersymmetric quantum field theories, which make lots of contact in some topics in mathematics, such as knot theory or a study of differential equations. So defects are in general very important tools in describing nature. For example, defects could be used to model quantum impurities. It could be used to model boundaries of finite size systems. It could be also used to model domain walls separating differently ordered regimes. And from the formal quantum field theory point of view, defects are also essential ingredients to understand, in particular, the non-perturbative perspectives of quantum field theories. So things like land defects, surface defects, and domain walls all play important roles in the study of quantum field theories. So motivated by these two big collections of reasons to study these kind of things, today I will be looking at entanglement entropy in 1 plus 1D with defects. So this talk will be divided into two parts. The first part will be about entanglement entropy in some 1D critical quantum spin chains with defects. So majority of the first part will be about a transverse field Ising model, where we'll review existing work, and I will add references as we go. And I will also mention some work in progress with Linnea Grant-Samuelson, Ananda Roy, and Hubert Salu on topological defects in three-state POTS model and associated study of entanglement entropy in such systems. And in the second part of my talk, I will turn to field theoretical methods, which is like, you could think of sort of like the first part is a discrete version, a lattice version, in the spin chain models, and the second part will be in continuum field theoretical method to compute entanglement entropy using the replica trick. And again, the second part will be mostly about some review of existing work, and also I will mention near the end, I will mention some work in progress with Ananda Roy and Yifan Wang. So just a disclaimer that today I will be only look at bipartite quantum systems where the total system is in its ground state. However, those methods, both in the lattice and the continuum, you could generalize such things to like more complicated situations. Even in 1 plus 1D, you could have like multiple partite, and then you could study like a more general entangled quantities such as negativity, etc. And those methods could be generalized to such situations too. And I should also say like the 1 plus 1D case is sort of like approachable both from the numerical point of view and also analytical point of view. However, the ultimate goal, of course, is to try to say something about higher dimensions, for example, in 2 plus 1D or in 3 plus 1D. Okay, so let me start. I should say, like, whenever you have questions or comments, just please let me know at any time. So I'll start with this transverse fieldizing model. This transverse fieldizing model is a 1D quantum spin chain where on each side there is a spin 1/2 system. And here I write down this Hamiltonian. It contains two different kinds of terms. So the first term is this nearest neighbor ferromagnetic interaction. And the second term is this transverse field. I've written down this Hamiltonian for its open boundary condition spin chain. And you could also close it up by make it a circle or consider periodic boundary conditions. But here I just do this for convenience. And so here the sigma z and sigma x are just Pauli matrices. And I could also represent this model using this diagrammatic method, where each blue dot corresponds to this spin 1/2 system, and this horizontal bound corresponds to this nearest neighbor interaction, and the vertical line corresponds to the transverse field. This transverse fieldizing model has a Z2 global symmetry. And so there has been recently sort of like a generalization of the global symmetry. So throughout my talk, when I talk about global symmetry, it's always a zero form global symmetry. So we have this Z2 symmetry. And the charge operator for this Z2 symmetry, which is codimension 1 in 1 plus 1D, namely it's supported along the whole space, is given by the product of the transverse field on each side. And in particular, this charge commutes with the Hamiltonian. Therefore, you have this Z2 symmetry. Now, the transverse fieldizing model are interesting to study because you sort of have a computation between these two terms. So this ferromagnetic interaction, they want to align the spins along the z direction, either all up or down. And this transverse field tend to make a preferred direction in the x direction, which if you translate back to the computational basis of the z direction, then you get a superposition of the possible states. So as you could imagine, as you vary this transverse field strength, h here, you will have some phase transition. So in particular, for h bigger than 1, you have a so-called disordered phase, or paramagnetic phase, which is a gapped Z2 symmetry preserving phase. And for h smaller than 1, you have ordered phase, or ferromagnetic phase, which is, again, a gapped but Z2 symmetry breaking phase. Exactly at h equal to 1, the system goes through a second-order quantum phase transition, which there's this critical point in the continuum is going to be described by the Ising CFT. So now, let's say, how does this entanglement entropy behave in this transverse fieldizing model? So the setup is the following. I will consider the total, the total Hilbert space here for this whole chain would, of course, be n tensor product of n copies of C squared. So as such, I will make a bipartition for this total system, where I define my subsystem A as a spin block of L sites, and then the rest of it will be called A complement. Now, the total Hilbert space in this case has this tensor product structure, namely the Hilbert space with respect to the subsystem, tensor with the Hilbert space of the complement of the subsystem. Now, let me emphasize that here it is natural to have this tensor product structure. And this kind of tensor product structure is definitely not natural, for example, in continuum. So namely, people often call this tensor product structure as sort of like a clear-cut decomposition, which is natural in the spin chain setup. But in the continuum, you would be need to be very careful about how you regularize, like the cut, the entanglement cut. And I will get to that part in the second part of my talk. And this kind of regularization is very important because to extract any physical information, you have to keep consistent, keep your regularization choice consistent. And that's like a prerequisite for you to actually extract anything physical. And I will talk about it more in the continuum side in the second part of my talk. Okay, so now we take this tensor product structure, and now assuming the total total system is in its ground state, where the state is denoted as psi g, I could trace out the complement of the subsystem and define the density matrix, and then define this von Neumann entropy as zero. So one question you could ask is, what is the dependence of this von Neumann entropy with respect to the subsystem size, namely with respect to L? And the answer to this question will depend on whether you are at a critical point or not. So away from the critical point, if you increase the size of the subsystem, your entropy will grow, and it will saturate to some certain value determined by your correlation length in the system. As you could imagine, at the critical point, the correlation length will go to infinity, and the entanglement entropy will grow unboundedly with respect to the subsystem size. In particular, it grows logarithmically with respect to the subsystem sum L. I should make a remark that here I'm not taking into account the finite size effects, namely whatever my subsystem L is, the total spin change is much, much larger than L. Of course, when you have actually a finite system, there are all kinds of finite size effects, but I'm omitting that kind of finite size effects here. In particular, at the critical point, you have this logarithmic dependence with some coefficient. In particular, here it's 1 over 6, which is the central charge for the Ising CFT 1/2 divided by 3. And then there is also some subleading term. And this kind of results could also be very easily reproduced in the continuum CFT, which I will reveal briefly in the second part of my talk. So part of the motivation of the study of this entanglement entropy with defects case is to see how does the inclusion of defect changes this kind of scaling behavior of your entanglement entropy. And I would be specifically interested in the critical systems case. So namely, you still have this logarithmic scaling. However, the various different terms in this expression will depend on defect. And then the question is, how does it depend on defect? And whether one can extract the defect data reliably by keeping track of the regularization choice carefully. Okay, so now, are there any questions at this point? Sorry, this might be very fundamental for the condensed matter point of view. So as a energy theorist, I should say I don't know quite much condensed matter physics. So if I say something wrong, or if you think you have some comments, please feel free to interrupt me. Okay, so. Now, the first task I would like to do before talking about the entanglement entropy in defects case is to introduce defect. And I will divide this task into two parts. So the first part, I will describe how do you think about defects in the continuum as in CFT. And then the second part, I will describe how do you realize them in the transverse field Ising model, namely on the lattice. So I should say that when I say defect, it's a point like defect in space. However, it extends along time direction. So from the 1 plus 1D point of view, it's a land defect. So on the continuum, I will be considering land defects in the Ising CFT. And a particular subclass of such lines are the so-called topological lines in the Ising CFT. So the terminology topological means that if you deform this line defects a little bit, as long as it doesn't cross some local operator insertions under which the topological line will act, then nothing really changes. So that's what this name topological means. And I will explain what topological means on the lattice in the next slide. Okay, so what are the topological lines in the Ising CFT? The Ising CFT has central charge C equals 1/2. It's a diagonal. It's probably it is the simplest diagonal rational CFT. In particular, it's the corresponding chi algebra is this M4,3 Virasoro minimum model. So in particular, there are three Virasoro primaries. So those local operator, local primary fields in the Ising CFT, you have identity, where which is 0, 0 conformal weight with respect to the left and right moving chiral algebra. And you have the energy field where H is equal, where the left and right moving weight is both 1/2. And also you have the spin field where the left and right moving conformal weight is given by 1/16. So a particular feature of the diagonal CFT is that there are one-to-one correspondence between the topological lines in this diagonal CFT and the primary field in this RCFT. One way to understand this is to go to the 2D-3D correspondence, but if you're interested, we can talk about this after the talk. But the bottom line is there are three topological lines in the Ising CFT, the so-called Werlinde lines. So what are these three lines? There is the identity line, which is trivial, so you do nothing, it's just identity line. And there is also the Z2 line, which I denote as eta, where recall that Ising model has a Z2 symmetry, so this Z2 line could be thought of generating this Z2 symmetry. And there is also this so-called Kramers Vanier duality line, which I denote as N. So the N line could be constructed in particular by gauging this Z2 only on half space, and then impose Dirichlet boundary condition for the Z2 gauge field on this, this half space where you gauge the Z2. And in particular, these lines, of course, identity lines is trivial, but the eta line and the Kramers-Vanier duality line, they satisfy the following, perhaps the simplest version of the Tambara-Yamagami fusion relation. So namely, N line fused with eta is equal to eta fused with N line, which is equal to N. And N fused itself is the sum of the identity line plus the Z2 line. And from this last fusion relation, you realize that the Kramers-Vanier duality line is non-invertible in the sense that it doesn't fuse according to some group law. And this fusion relation could also be like understand from this gauging procedure that I mentioned before. So the setup you will consider is you have two parallel, for example, parallel the Kramers-Vanier duality lines, and you gauge the Z2 symmetry in the middle slab. And as you squish them together, you will get a Z2 condensation defect, which is exactly this 1 plus eta on the right-hand side. Okay, so those are topological lines. Then one could ask the question of how do they act on, for example, my spin field. So the Z2 line is a Z2 symmetry, is spin flip symmetry, so it will put a minus sign on the spin field. So what does that mean is, suppose I have a Z2 line eta, and I have a local spin field insertion sigma here. If I pull this Z2 line across this sigma field, I will pick up a minus sign. So it's quite simple. It's just it's just consistent with how the Z2 symmetry would act. Now the Kramers-Vanier duality line acts more interestingly. So first of all, if you look at this fusion relation, you will realize that the N line has to annihilate the sigma field because 1 - 1 is equal to 0, and the square root of 0 is 0. So what happens is if you have a duality line and the spin field insertion, when you pull it over, the sigma field will disappear. And however, you will have a new disorder operator, which is attached to a Z2 line ending on this duality line N. This sort of picture could also be easily understand from this gauging Z2 on half space point of view, because when you gauge the Z2, of course, here Z2 is now also, when you gauge the Z2, you have a dual Z2 symmetry. And the generator for this dual Z2 symmetry is exactly the Z2 Wilson line on the other side. So this kind of picture makes sense. So those are the three topological lines in the continuum Ising CFT. Now I will talk about how do you actually realize these lines in the transverse field Ising model, namely on the lattice. So the Z2 line is easy to realize, and more generally, all the symmetry lines are easy to realize. Namely, you just need to look at how it acts on your fundamental spin field. So here you see that the Z2 line will act with a minus sign. So that means to increase a Z2 line defect is the equivalent to sort of changing your boundary condition from periodic to antiperiodic. Namely, what you do is suppose your defect is between set I0 and set I0 plus 1. What you will do is you change the minus sign of this paramagnetic interaction to plus sign. So namely, you change it here like this. And what does it mean for this defect to be topological? That means there exists a local unitary which by conjugating by this local unitary will take this defect location from between set I naught to and set I naught plus one to some other set, like for example to between set I naught plus k to I naught plus k plus one. And it's very easy to figure out what is this local unitary. This is literally given by conjugation by the sigma x operator on the set I naught. It's always given by, recall that the Z2 charge is defined as like a string operator or transverse field. So you literally just conjugate by this on-site local spin transverse field. Then that would shift your defect. And because it's a local unitary, so the spectrum, et cetera, doesn't change. So in that sense, it's a topological defect.
So is this the same as the one in the very beginning you said there is also Z2, like, lines in the along the this lattice.
Yes, that's an operator. This is a defect.
So the same line in just, like, just a different direction.
It's a different direction. However, we usually say the thing that's a parallel, like inserted at a point in time called operator, because it acts on the Hilbert space.
Yeah, yeah.
But the defect, yeah. So
that is also eta, right?
That is also eta, but. But here I want to make the distinction because this is literally 1D quantum spin chain breaks its Lorentz. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So the Z2 line of Z2 defect is perhaps a little bit boring. And now the Kramers Rainier duality defect is slightly more interesting. So what you do here is the following. So recall that we use this diagrammatic interpretation of the transverse field Ising model. So suppose still my defect site is between I naught and I naught plus one. So what I will do to insert a Kramers Rainier defect, duality defect, is to delete the transverse field on set I naught and also change the nearest neighbor interaction from the sigma z coupling to the sigma y sigma z coupling. So of course it's a little bit counterintuitive why is this exactly the Kramers Rainier duality line. So you could do the following checks. Like one of the stupidest checks is you could literally take this defect Hamiltonian, and then you could try to compute its spectrum. And then you could compare this spectrum, you could extract the spectrum by using this Cardiff formula of the finite size corrections, and then you could compare your result with the continuum prediction for this Kramers Rainier duality line. Where you sort of use the modulus transformation to work out those things and they match. And another way you could check that is you could consider fusion of the two Kramers Rainier duality lines on the lattice. Namely, suppose you have one duality line between set one and set two, another one between set two and set three. You could use a local unitary to move them on top of each other. And after you do that, you discover that this indeed looks like a direct sum of the identity line and Z2 line. And of course, a more intuitive way to think about this is you could perform Kramers Rainier duality only on one side of the defect. So for example, I could perform the Kramers Rainier duality on to the right side of the defect. Then this defect term will become some term which couples the original spin field and the twist spin field right as a defect. So that's like sort of like an intuitive way to say why that is a Kramers Rainier duality defect. And now I didn't write down what is this local unitary which realizes shifting this Kramers Rainier duality line, because it's very complicated. However, it's doable. And it's actually first work, not exactly sure first work out, but it was, for example, worked out in that paper. Okay, so those are the topological lines in the critical transverse field Ising model. Let me mention that critical transverse field Ising model is actually kind of special in the sense that you really have two continuous families of defects. And on the continuum, those continuous families of defects will flow two conformal lines in the Ising CFT. So I'll first talk about how do you insert this continuous families of defect in the spin chain language. So the first type is the so-called energy type. Of which the Z2 defect is a special case of this continuous family, in the sense like Z2 defect is topological. However, in general, this energy type is not topological. So what you do here is very simple. You literally put a defect strength term, which I call B here, in front of this ferromagnetic coupling. Again, the defect site is between set I naught and set I naught plus one. And this number b, in principle, could take any real number. So there are some special values which deserve some explanation. So if b equals 1, then you realize you've done nothing. So you just inserted nothing, and this corresponds to the identity line. B equals 2 minus 1 is, again, changing the boundary condition from periodic to antiperiodic, so you have the z2 line eta. However, if b goes to 0 or b goes to plus minus infinity, you have effectively decoupled the two sides. So basically, this defect will become a tensor product of boundary conditions for the left side and the right side. So for example, if b equals 0, you have free boundary conditions at the defect side for both left and right. If b goes to plus minus infinity, then you have the fixed boundary conditions. So those are the continuous families of energy type defect. And you could do something similar for the duality type. So namely, in this modified nearest neighbor coupling at the defect set, you also add a little defect strength, which I call b tilde here. Now, because there is a transverse field sigma x missing at the set I naught, I could do a simple local unitary, just conjugate by the sigma x and flip the sign of b tilde. So without loss and generality, I could take my b tilde. Sorry, yeah.
Sorry. When you're motivating the introduction of this kind of Hamiltonian,
yeah,
in the presence of defect line, you're using the conjugation of sigma x, for example, for the eta type defect line.
Right.
And the question is, if b is like 2 or 3, does it have this kind of conjugation probably?
Conjugation.
Yes.
No, it doesn't. It has to be. See, the conjugation only works when, say, b equals 1 or minus 1. That's why it's only topological at those special values.
So for b equals 2 or 3, I cannot think of them as topological defects.
Yes. In fact, they are not topological defects. In the continuum, they will correspond to the so-called conformal defect, which preserves the conformal symmetry. So that's a good question. So it's very important that this conjugation only works at those special values, and exactly at those values you get topological defect. Yeah. So thanks for the question. So for the duality defect, again, so b tilde could take some, we just restrict its value to be non-negative. Again, b tilde equals to plus 1 gives you this topological Kramers Rainier duality line. And b goes to 0 infinity, again, this defect becomes totally reflexive, namely you just decouple the two systems on these two sides. So those are the two continuous families of defect you could introduce in this critical transverse field Ising model. Now, if I think about this question in the continuum, as we said earlier, these continuous families of defect are literally continuous families of conformal lines in the Ising CFT. You could ask yourself, why do I have these continuous families of conformal lines in the Ising CFT? And there's a simple way to just like give you some intuition of why they exist. So the picture is the following. So you have, this is a 1 plus 1D picture, where this the blue direction is a time direction. So I have a line defect along time direction. And then it's a defect in the Ising CFT. Now by this folding trick, where I fold this picture along this defect, this picture will become the following. Namely, you have an Ising square theory, but on a half space. So your defect become a boundary condition in the Ising square theory. The Ising square theory just happens to be a Z2 orbifold of this free compact boson at a particular compact vacation radius. It's either square root of 2 or 2 times square root of 2, depending on your convention, but it's at a fixed particular compact vacation radius. So you have this boundary condition for this free compact boson theory. Now the natural continuous families of boundary conditions are just given by the Dirichlet and Neumann boundary conditions, where Dirichlet boundary condition is literally, you suppose we call this compact boson phi, you just restrict the value of the phi to be given by some value in this compact vacation, in this S1 target space, and it's a continuous family. And similarly, you could also consider the Neumann boundary condition, which equivalently fix the dual scalar, the T dual scalar, of this very compact boson. So again, it's a continuous family. And then after you unfold it, the Dirichlet boundary condition becomes energy type defect, and the Neumann boundary condition will become the duality type defect. This is like the physical motivation for, or intuition for, why you have these continuous families or defects in the critical transverse field Ising model. And this is a very special case. So in general, it's like this kind of continuous family would not be existing. Like, so that's why, like, in the when I talk about POTS model, I will only be talking about topological defect. Okay, so now we're ready to answer the question, what is the behavior of the ground state entanglement entropy in this context of the transverse field Ising model with defect? As you could imagine, the answer to this question depends not only on your subsystem size, but also depends on the relative position between the defect and the subsystem. So the most simplest case is the following. Namely, I have this transverse field Ising chain, and the orange line denotes where my defect is, and I will pick my subsystem to be symmetrically arranged around the defect, or the defect is right in the middle of my subsystem. It's the spin block of L set. And in that case, we talked about folding. So if you fold it, this is a boundary, like a BCFT case where you have your subsystem with some interval which ends on the boundary. And in that case, you could explicitly compute the dependence of this entropy analytically. And what you will get is very similar to the case without defect. Namely, you have, again, the logarithmic scaling where it's a coefficient central charge divided by 3. It's similar to the case without defect. However, there is also a subleading term. And of course, again, when you talk about the subleading constant term, it's always tricky to extract physical information because there is a stabilization dependence. However, here, when you vary the defect, which I denote D here, the subleading term could be written as a sum, which as a non-universal piece, which I call delta, which is the same for different defect, plus actual defect dependent case, which sometimes people call defect entropy or log of the g function for the defect. And this g function is one of the examples which is monotonic decreasing along the RG flow. So it's like the defect version of the central charge C, or like in high dimension you have the A theorem, et cetera. So this is like a similar RG, a monotonic decreasing quantity brought up by because you have defects in your system. And there are also higher dimensional generalizations to this case. If you have a surface defect, then there is also a surface defect version of A theorems, et cetera. So this is one way to see that there is this physical meaningful thing hiding in the subleading term of the entanglement entropy. And you could also see this numerically. So for example, I should say that this G function, so I talked about these two continuous families. For all energy type defect, they will have g function equal to 1. For all duality type g function, duality type defects, the g function is square root of 2. So namely, if I plot this the symmetric configuration entropy against the subsystem size, that I will say roughly like two straight lines with the slope given by C over 3. However, the offset will be, for example, the green dots correspond to the Kramers Vernier duality line. The red ones correspond to the Z2 line or identity line because they belong to the same class. And if you look at the offset, they differ by roughly log of square root of 2. So from this difference of this offset, you can extract the non-trivial G function for the duality, the Kramers Vernier duality line. And let me mention also that the square root of 2 is also the quantum dimension corresponding to this Kramers Vernier duality line. So this is the simplest case of the, yeah.
So does that formula apply only if the defect is right in the middle of the subregion?
Yeah, so here it's tricky. So we're talking about topological defect. So it's like if you move it a little bit, it doesn't change much. However, it will change if you move the defect right at the entanglement cut.
But
so in general, it will, in general, for this non-topological ones, it will change when you move this defect location. So part of the second part of the talk is sort of like trying to say how to analytically compute such kind of dependence when you arbitrarily move the defect.
So that figure is only for B and B tilde equal to 1.
Yes. So this is literally the two topological lines I talked about earlier. The B tilde equals 1, the duality line, and the Z2 line, which corresponds to B equals to minus 1. Yeah. Right. So as I said, this is the simplest case, and then you could consider other cases. For example, I mentioned a little bit that this is the case where the subsystem, the defect is exactly at the entanglement cut, or you could do a more like more intervals, and you could do like two intervals on two sides of the defect and arbitrarily distance from each other. And of course, you could ask the question of what is the entanglement between these two, which could be detected by, the, for example, the entanglement negativity and things like that. And I should say that in the most generic case, there isn't a nice analytical formula for these kind of things, which is also part of my motivation to study this kind of replica check computation in the CFT language, which I will talk about in the second half of the talk. Yeah.
You mentioned that log 2 over 2 is the log quantum dimension. Is there a relation between quantum dimension and G function?
Yeah, there is. So for these Wernicke lines, it's all given by this quantum dimension. Mm-hmm. So I should say, like, a quantum dimension, one way to think about this is a 2D, 3D correspondence. You have a 3D TQFT on a slab, and then you have anion lines in the TQFT. And this is literally the anion line quantum dimension, because if you push that anion line to the boundary, you squish this this slab, and then you get topological line in the 2D CFT. So for those Wernicke lines, it's always given by such things.
Just to make sure, if I have just regular symmetry defect, then this G will be 1. And
yeah.
Two lines will collapse with each other.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So for non-invertible ones, it's given, it's non-trivial. Yeah. Okay. So this so much is about transverse fieldizing model. So let me just say a few words about the three-state POTS model. Why three-state POTS model or clock model? Because it's like a natural generalization for the Ising case, where now on the each site or each qubit you have a spin one system instead of spin one half. And then the Hamiltonian also looks very similar. So here, you just need to use some like a 3x3 matrices, which generalize your Pauli matrices, which I denote here as sigma, sigma, theta, and the transverse field on tau. And sigma could be viewed as measuring the spin. So you have spin either at 12 o'clock or 4 o'clock or 8 o'clock. And then tau could be viewed as an operator which shifts the spin. And they satisfy the following relation, where omega is e to the 2 pi over 3. That's the fundamental third root of unity. And the POTS model, just like the Ising model has a Z2 symmetry, the POTS model has a S3 symmetry, permuting the three configurations of spin. And this S3 could be understood as a semi-direct product of Z3 and a Z2 charge conjugation. So again, you could write down the Z3 charge operator as a string, which is it takes the product of transverse field along the whole spin chain, which is given as here. And you could see that the fundamental spin field sigma is charge 1 under the Z3 symmetry. And similarly, you could write down this Z2 charge conjugation operator, and it just literally conjugates sigma to sigma dagger. Now, the POTS model is very similar to Ising in the sense that it also has a computation between this ferromagnetic interaction and the transverse field. In particular, if my transverse field strength H is bigger than one, you have disordered phase, gapped symmetry preserving. H smaller than one, you have ordered symmetry breaking phase, which is also gapped. And at H equals 1, you again have a second order quantum phase transition, which in the continuum is described by the three-state POTS CFT. I should say, like, of course, you could generalize to like n by n matrices, but this is a second order phase transition stops at n equals 4. So of course, you could study that, but you don't get all these things for free, like this nice second-order quantum phase transition. Okay, so this three-state POTS CFT, what is it? It has central charge 0.8, and it's non-diagonal model. And the corresponding Cairo algebra is the M6,5 minimum model. And it has 12 Virasoro primary local operators. So as you could imagine that here, just matching this continuum local primaries operators with the fundamental clock model degree of freedom is already non-trivial. So because this sigma and sigma dagger will be mapped to two of the lowest scaling dimension primary field in this POTS model. However, there are many others which will be given by some sort of combination of this sigma and tau field on the lattice. So let's see what are the topological lines in the POTS CFT. There are in total 17 of them. I should say, like, I'm only considering the so-called simple topological lines, which means topological lines which cannot be written as a sum of other simple lines. And luckily, these 17 topological lines are generated by only 5 of them, or 4 non-trivial ones, because you have identity. And you also have these symmetry lines, which is a Z3 line called eta, and Z2 charge conjugation line called C. And there's also a Kramers-Vanier duality line N here. And there's also a W line, which sometimes people call it Fibonacci annual line because it satisfies this golden ratio of Fielder relation, namely W squared is equal to 1 plus W. So part of this work in progress with these people are to actually construct these five lines, okay, four lines, because identity line is nothing, on these four lines on the clock model. So the W line is quite messy, so I will not talk about here. However, the symmetry lines and the Kramers-Vanier duality lines are still look like sort of nice and simple. So again, to write down this symmetry defect, it's again sort of simple. Namely, you just need to know how this defect acts on the fundamental spin field. So for example, for the Z3 line, I could again write it as sort of like a change of boundary condition by inserting this phase e to the 2 pi over 3, because my sigma field is charged, which has charge 1 under the Z3 symmetry. And for the Z2 charge conjugation line, because this Z2 charge conjugation takes sigma to sigma dagger and vice versa, so I would just need to change this nearest neighbor coupling from sigma dagger sigma to sigma dagger sigma dagger. So which is also like physically intuitive, this is how you construct these symmetry lines. Now the Kramers-Vanier duality line is also sort of similar to the Ising case. So what you do is you then delete this transverse field on the set I0 and also change the this nearest neighbor interaction to be the following thing. So you have sigma, product sigma and tau at I0 and then sigma dagger at set I0 plus 1. Again, you could understand this Kramers-Vanier duality line by gauging this Z3 symmetry on like one half of this defect. Now, the total Fielding relation between the lines are more complicated. However, there's a subspace which is generated by the eta line and the Kramers-Vanier duality line. They sort of form this Z3 version of the Tambara-Yamagami Fielding relation. So now one could again look at the ground state entanglement entropy for this POTS model with insertions of these topological defects. Again, I could look at in the simplest case where the defect is in the middle of this subsystem A. Again, I could try to fit this entropy with respect to subsystem size. I should say, like in the actual figure, we're actually doing this on the periodic chain. So instead of fitting it directly with respect to the subsystem length, you should use the so-called charge length, which is the equivalent to the length in this infinite chain setup. So if you do this charge length, then you have those dots are going to be given by the finite size effects. And if you look at the smaller size points, you could fit it with some straight line. And the slope is roughly given by 0.8 divided by 3. And if you look at the offset, where this green line corresponds to the duality defect and this blue line corresponds to the Z3 defect, you see this difference given by log of square root of 3, where square root of 3 is also the G function for the duality line or the quantum dimension for the duality defect. So this is roughly like a little bit what happens in the POTS model. So let me just make an intermediate summary before I briefly talk about the continuum computation. So I talked about this entanglement entropy in 1D critical quantum spin chains with defects using these two models as examples. I also talked a little bit how do you extract physical data from the scaling behavior of this entanglement entropy. In particular, how do you get defect G function out of this kind of entanglement entropy?
Well, when we put in two N defects, do you get a direct sum of the eta defect?
It's a direct sum of identity line and the eta line.
Yes, but in entanglement entropy, does it just separate into sum of S A comma D zeros?
I would think so, yeah. But I didn't study this kind of situation numerically.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you can extract the entire fusion algebra from...
Well, no, it's more... I think it would be tricky to extract fusion algebra directly from entanglement. It's also like there are easier ways to extract fusion algebra from other things. So I would think it's doable, but Yeah, I'm not completely sure. Yeah. I mean, because I'm not completely sure. Yeah. But that's a good point. Like in principle, you could perhaps use fusion. Use entanglement entropy data to extract the fusion algebra. And you could also ask other things because I only talked about the fusion data, but there is also the F symbol and stuff. You could ask how do you see that on the spin chain? That's also something interesting that I don't have a good answer right now.
Sorry, in terms of Pontonian, what does direct sum mean?
Yeah, the direct sum just means like if you think of this eigenspace, you see this block decomposition where one subspace corresponds to this periodic boundary condition, which means identity line, and then the other one corresponds to this anti-periodic boundary condition, which corresponds to the eta line.
I mean, in terms of Hamiltonian, what is
So what happens is like when you move this defect on top of each other, you will produce some term. Let's say the two defect is between like set 1, 2 and set 2 and 3. And after you do this local unit, remove them on top of each other, you will say something like a sigma z1 at set 1, sigma x at set 2, sigma z at set 3. But the sigma x at set 2 is like only appears in that term. So this operator on set 2 is completely decoupled from everything else. So then you could diagonalize your eigenspace just by the eigenvalue of the sigma 2x, which has plus 1 or minus 1. And effectively, if it's a plus 1 eigenspace, then you have periodic boundary condition. Then if it's a minus 1, then yeah, it's that. That's how you sort of see this direct sum in this language. Yeah, that's a good question.
Thanks.
Okay, so let me just briefly go through the continuum. I think I have like 12 minutes left. So, but anyway, so the replica trick. I told you that this kind of tensor product decomposition of the total Hilbert space is not natural in the continuum. But let's forget it. Forget about it for a second. Just say suppose we have this tensor product composition where A is a subsystem, and then as usual we take the total system state to be some pure state psi, and then the entanglement entropy or phenomenal entropy is defined as follows, where rho is the the density matrix. And now I should say like here, of course you could compute it in this formula. However, the appearance of log inside the trace is a bad news because that means you literally need to diagonalize this density matrix. So replica trick is sort of like a trick to move this log outside of the trace in some sense. So namely, what you will do is you consider this so-called nth Rennie entropy, which is defined as like 1 over 1 minus n log or trace of rho to the nth power. And then if you take the limit of n goes 1, then you would recover the phenomenal entropy. I should say that this is much harder set than being done because this Rennie entropy, as you could say, it's only defined by positive integer. And if you want to take the n goes 1 limit, you really need to do this analytical continuation into the whole positive real number. And then in practice, that could be tricky. So this is all set using this assumption that the total Hilbert space really has this tensor product decomposition. But in practice, what do you do? So I have a continuum. So this is like my one-dimensional space, which is a continuous straight line. I take my subsystem to be some interval A. In general, this total Hilbert space cannot be written as this kind of tensor product decomposition. But what I could do is to insert a little boundary condition at the endpoint of this entanglement point or the endpoint of the interval, and I will specify some boundary condition there. In principle, I could specify different boundary conditions on these two because it's like, okay, 1D is special because it's a disconnected case, but here I just take the same boundary condition, and I say this boundary condition has size epsilon, say. After I do that, I have a tensor product decomposition between the Hilbert space for subsystem A with the boundary condition little a, and the Hilbert space for the A complement system with, again, boundary condition little a. So then you could just go back to this kind of definition to compute your entropy. And of course, you could see that because you have specified your choice or regularization, the entropy will, again, depend on, say, the size of the boundary and also what kind of boundary condition you put at the entangling point. So then again, to extract anything physical, you have to be very careful about all kinds of regularizations. Okay, so let me just briefly say what is exactly this replica trick in the continuum, namely this path integral formulation of the replica trick. So the first thing to notice is like if I take this sort of like amplitude for this density matrix, it boils down to computing the following partition function, namely a partition function on this plane with a slit open along the subsystem A, where you have the sort of like a field configuration as the two slits specified by the incoming and outgoing state. And also, because we regularize the entangling point, so you have a little boundary here at the endpoint with size epsilon and with the choice of boundary condition A. I should say, like in general, you don't have to put in a conformal boundary condition, but here I just put in a conformal boundary condition. If you didn't put in conformal boundary condition, we'll do the replica trick. This boundary condition will sort of flow as you increase the number of replicas. So there will be something tricky there, but let's just put a conformal boundary condition there. And okay, then from here, to compute trace of rho to the nth power, we'll boil down to compute this partition function on this n-fold cover of this configuration, where along the subsystem, you have a z mod n branch cut, like this cyclically cyclic action on the different sheets of this replica manifold. So that's how you compute this thing. So let's just carry out this computation because it's simple enough. So they have this y interval, and you have this nth cover of this plane case. And now you could do a conformal transformation to map it to a cylinder. So you could think of it as two steps. The first step, map this interval to a half line, and then map it to, using this radial quantization picture, you map it to a cylinder. In particular, the cylinder has length 2 times log of L over epsilon, where L again is the subsystem size, epsilon is the regularization size. And also the for this nth cover, you have the circumference of the cylinder given by 2 pi n. And by a modulus transformation, this partition function becomes an amplitude, like namely between the two boundary state corresponding to the boundary condition. Those are the Cauchy state corresponding to the conformal boundary condition. And you could carry out the calculation, and you get something like this. So it scales as L to the power of minus 2 delta n, where delta n, I will explain there is a physical meaning for it in the next slide. It's C over 12 times A minus 1 over n. And also, there's something appearing, which I also call it a G function for this boundary condition A. However, this is the boundary condition that I put in to regularize. It's not any physical boundary condition. So that's something to keep in mind. And from here, you could compute the Ren E and then take n goes to one limit. You do indeed recover the, you know, the expected log scaling with C over 3 coefficient. Now, this is like here we compute everything using replica manifold formalism. There's an equivalent way to think about this thing. So instead of computing partition function on this n-fold cover, I could compute a different partition function, which is a different theory, sort of like n copies of original theory, but just on the plane, with actual insertions of two so-called twist field, which I denote as phi and phi bar here. So this is a two-point function in this so-called replica theory, which is like a cyclic orbifold of like n tensor products of original theory. And this twist field has scaling dimension exactly given by delta n, which is C over 12 times n minus 1 over n, which we have seen on the last slide. And you could see that you know, you have CFT, you have two-point function, so it should scale as like L to the power of minus 2 delta n, which is as expected. But also, there, your regularization choice that we were careful to do on the last slide translates into sort of like a normalization for this twist field in this replica theory. Okay, so now if I want to use the replica trick for the setup that I'm interested in, namely to compute entanglement entropy in presence of a land effect in 2D CFT, I would, for example, if I think of my subsystem A to be a union of two intervals on the two sides of the land effect, it literally boils down to compute the following four-point function, but in presence of a land effect. And I should say this land effect will also be n-dependent. So this is not your original land effect. It's the uplift of your original land effect in this replica theory. Namely, you need to take this Zn invariant, the cyclic Zn symmetry invariant combinations of each copies of land effect. And why do I emphasize this? It's because if you want to study, so this correlation function, of course, will receive contributions from the operators living on the line. But to enumerate this operator is not as simple as it sounds like, because you would need to take the original line operator spectrum, but then you need to project out like the things that you don't want. And there will be n dependent. So the concrete spectrum will be depending on this replica index. So it's more complicated than you would think about. Okay, so in general, this kind of correlator is hard to compute. But let me just briefly mention like a simpler case, or simpler in the sense that it's manageable, but it's still kind of complicated in general. Namely, it's a BCFT case. So instead of a line defect, I would just consider in CFT on half space with some boundary, with some conformal boundary, a boundary condition I call it A. So the simplest case is like I could take my subsystem to be an interval ending on this boundary. And in this case, the CFT computation is quite simple. So basically, when you compute this replica manifold partition function, you could again do a conformal map to map this thing to a disk where your twist field insertion is at the origin. And then from there, you again map it to like nth cover and map it to cylinder. So you could just compute this thing easily. And this in the twist field formalism, this is a one-point function of this phi bar n twist field in presence of the defect. Sorry, boundary. I should say this is also bn here. Okay, so from here, then you could recover this entropy dependence that we talked about earlier. So namely, you have a log dependence with the system size, but there's also this g function, which appears in the subleading term. So this is the simplest case, but let's consider the next simplest case where the subsystem is an interval, but it's not touching your boundary. So namely, it's like a generic interval with endpoint x1, x2. So this will boil down to like some to compute the two-point function in presence of this boundary. And this kind of two-point function, the concrete form of this two-point function has not been worked out, but there's some limit of this two-point function has been considered in the holography context by, for example, these people. So how do you think about this two-point function? So the reason why the boundary case is simpler than the line defect case is because the kinematics is simpler. So there is this so-called reflection trick or doubling trick, namely says which says that the two-point function in presence of boundary takes the same kind of kinematic form as a chiral four-point function, where just the four-point are going to be given by these two, and the reflection of those 2 points with respect to the boundary. So in that sense, I could write down like at least kinematically, I could get the form of this kind of two-point function. So it will depend on this cross ratio between these 4 points. And then there's also this big f function depending on eta, which you could write down in terms of conformal blocks. And there are two different channels for you to do so. So I should say that eta is some real number between 0 and 1. And so when eta is sort of small, namely correspond to the case where these 2 points are close to the boundary, then the natural or the natural thing to consider is so-called boundary channel. Namely, you first write down this expansion of this twist field in terms of boundary operators, and then take the two-point function on the boundary. So the end result is the following. So you have a sum over the contribution of these boundary operators, OJ. And remind you, the spectrum of boundary operator will depend on n, because you need to do this careful projection of this cyclic orbifold. And then you need to know some two-point function correlation coefficients between the twist field and the boundary operator, which is also computable. And then the big building block is going to be given by this four-point chiral block in the S channel. So which again, the total analytical form for such conformal block is not known, but you could write it in terms of expansion in the cross ratio eta. And in particular, if eta goes to zero, the dominant contribution will come from the vacuum channel. And then this whole thing will collapse to this simple expression. And similarly, if you take the limit of eta goes to 1, the dominant channel will be the Bach channel. So namely, you first fuse these two twist fields. And then whatever appears in the fusion channel, then you could compute the one-point function of this phi I here. So namely, the sum will be over this Bach primary. So again, you need to enumerate the correct Bach primaries by taking into account this kind of cyclic orbifold. And then with some compute this 3-point function coefficient and also 1-point function coefficient. And then you have this conformal block in the T channel. So again, as eta goes 1, the dominant internal channel is given by the identity module, and then again this whole thing will collapse to something simpler. So what does that mean for the entanglement entropy? Namely, as eta goes to zero and eta goes to one, I could write down such sort of expression for the Renyi entropy and also for the entanglement entropy. So you could see that as eta goes to one, the expression is completely the same as if there's no boundary, which makes sense because if your interval is really far away from your boundary, it doesn't really feel it. However, as eta goes to zero, you will see that there will be the dependence will be unexpected because it really depends on the separate distance of this interval, like x1 and x2 are how far away the two endpoints are. Now, again, the natural question is what about the intermediate scaling behavior for the intermediate region of eta goes between 0 and 1? So this is something that I'm working on right now by including this kind of, instead of a vacuum module, we increase the higher and higher order contributions in eta or 1 minus eta, and then to try to get what's the behavior in the intermediate region. So I'm sorry for 2 minutes over time, but let me just summarize. So I talked to you about this two-part story about entanglement entropy. The first part is more discrete on the spin chain system, where I talked about the transverse fieldizing and the three-step pots. And then the second part is a little bit about this field theoretical replica check method. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Question?
In your bulk channel, that does that look like some kind of effluent in some kind of module category?
I don't think so, but this kind of crossing relation, it does look like an F move just because, this. but I don't think there is. If you want to define this as a F symbol, you can, but it's different from the F symbol in the module tensor kind.
I just heard that somebody is thinking about using boundary condition in terms of module category, but I have another question. In the previous slide, you mentioned this kind of conformal boundary condition. Is there also a category description of the conformal boundary condition that you mentioned in the Z2 IC model case? And I believe it is in the previous. But yeah, this.
Yeah.
Is there?
You mean conformal boundary in just one copies of IC?
Yes.
Then there's just three of them, because these are correspond to the you could write down the corresponding Cardy state.
So these are just corresponding to.
Right. So on the spin chain, it's very intuitive. So what are the three? So there are two fixed boundary conditions, namely you fix the spin to be up or down on the boundary, and the free boundary condition, which you do nothing, just treat it as the open chain.
So they just correspond to the Cardy states.
Yeah, they just correspond to the Cardy states because this is a rational RCFT. So there it's for other RCFT, it's just it's Cardy states. Yeah.
So in IR, the G function takes a universal value, right? So for the central charge, we notice something like the OP coefficient of stress tensor, something like that. How about the G function?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one can also sort of extract the G function from that kind of language, I don't want to say it's you could extract it from this. I mean, there is one way I could say it in terms of a concrete partition function. So namely, if you consider a 2D CFT on a disk with this boundary condition put at the circle boundary of the disk, it's literally given by the disk partition function. Yeah. You could say it perhaps in the stress tensor language too, but.
Yeah, because I saw the G function appear somewhere in your calculation of the 4-point function.
Somewhere. Yeah. So there, I use this disk partition function. Yeah. So let me. This is not a physical G function, but. Unfortunately. So here I wrote the G function, but this is not a physical boundary, but the regularization boundary. But this is given by. This A is the corresponding Cardy states for this boundary condition. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly the disk partition function that I was talking about.
Thanks.
So like you could map it to a cylinder, so it would be like a semi-infinite cylinder with this. And then there's this inner product between the Cauchy state and the zero. Yeah, those are the vacuum. Yeah.
In the first part of your talk, so if you change the size of the subsystem that includes the defect,
yeah,
and how does the final shift of the entanglement entropy depends on
you mean like
size of
when the size is like not negligible? Yeah, so
it saturate to some constant shift that you observe. So how does it saturate to?
Yeah. So that kind of like depends on what kind of defect you have. So for example, if you consider this Kramers-Vanier duality defect, there are some trapped zero modes in that case. So that will contribute to this sort of like a finite size correction. But if you have this Z2 defect, then there isn't. So it depends on what like the defect data. And I should say like it's probably, I didn't include the finite size effect, but there's a more detailed description of this kind of finite size effect in this paper. But the bottom line is how does it saturate sort of like depend on your defect data?
Is it generically some power law in 1 over L?
Power law?
Yeah.
No. So you're talking about this. But I'm not sure it's there is directly like a power law 1 over L. I need to check like what's the exact finite size correction. I'm not sure it's like a power law 1 over L. Yeah. But I need to check and then.
Any more questions? Yeah, now let's thank Fei again.
Thank you.